Devices Radio Network.
Presented by NAPS Gear.
Advices Radio is for entertainment and educational purposes only. The opinions of the host are not meant to be taken as medical advice. If you have a health concern, see a doctor immediately.
When it comes to the day of the contest, I'm his father. He comes to me for advices. So it's not that hard for me to give him the wrong advices. Advices.
When I was a little kid, I used to go to the gym with my dad. Maybe 6, 7 years old. It's not really that I wanted to go to the gym and work out. I just like spending time with him. He would take me, and as long as I stayed off to the side and didn't get in the way, the gym owners didn't mind if I was there. I'd bring a bag of drawing books and other things to keep me entertained and basically, you know, just hang out and do little kid stuff. But I do remember looking up, and I remember seeing the guys training. This place was filled with monsters. The only time I'd ever seen anything like this was like in comic books or watching The Incredible Hulk on TV. I continued to go with my dad, and over time, I began lifting weights too. I don't even really remember the age that I started. I just know that I did. I can't even remember the first time I picked up a dumbbell. Eventually, I branched out and I started going to other gyms. But I remember that all the gyms gave me that same feeling. They all felt like home to me. Since then, things have changed. I don't know where they changed or how they changed, but they did. Fast forward to last spring. I was training with two of my friends. It was Saturday. It was leg day. We are at a big corporate gym. It's a place that used to be considered hardcore, but now it's just like any other corporate gym. This was right before the Michigan State Championships. For those of you that don't know, people around here take the Michigan seriously. It's like the Olympia to some guys. It's pretty cool to see, and there's an awesome energy. Anyway, both of my friends were doing the Michigan, and after we were done training, they asked me if I would help them work on their posing. So after we were done training, my two friends and I went upstairs to one of the studios. They wanted to practice posing and get my opinion. They were both looking really good. Like I said, it was just a couple weeks out, and they were suffering. These guys were putting everything they had into it. One of them has his shirt off. He has his shorts on and his shoes on, but his shirt was off. And while he was working on his front double bicep pose, I saw out of the corner of my eye somebody by the door. It was one of the salespeople. He was with two women, and I'm going to have to guess that they were potential customers that he was showing around. Needless to say, I got a bad feeling about this right away. He showed them some equipment, and then he came back. He opened the door, walked in the studio, and he said, "Guys, you can't do that in here." Like I said, I had a feeling something was about to go down, so I wasn't caught off guard. I wasn't surprised. I just looked at him, and I said, "Okay, well, where can we go? Because I know they do have other studios, and this one did have glass in the front, so I thought maybe he would suggest we went to a more secluded location." Instead, his response was, and I gotta be honest, he did sound kind of condescending and kind of judgmental. He said, "You can go home, or you can go to another facility, but you can't do that in here." And he looked at us like we're kind of crazy. And look, thing is, I get it. Bodybuilding is kind of crazy. It is kind of weird. But the gym is the only place that I've ever been able to feel at home as a bodybuilder. The only place where I didn't feel like I was different or outside. And the part that really was confusing to me was I understood his perspective. I mean, he's just a sales guy. He's just trying to make money. I mean, he saw us as being something that would deter him from making money. And I gotta respect that. We all need to make a living, and that's what this place is about for him. But it certainly reminded me that I wasn't at home anymore. even if I was in a gym that had a bodybuilder on the logo, and even if the owner of the gym goes to the Arnold Classic every year to sell t-shirts based off of the legacy of what his gym used to be, this place is not my home. So the whole thing left me a little bit angry, kind of sad, and definitely confused. And that's what I want to flush out here. I want to talk to people. I want to figure this out. Today, on Advices Radio, the death of the hardcore gym. Stay tuned.
So I was brought up with stories of Reg Park, seven-time Mr. Scotland's, hearing about Sean Connery when he trained in the gym. So to me, that's what gyms were. There weren't chains of gyms. There weren't gyms that you could go in and get pizza. There wasn't gyms that you could go in and you had to wear a wristband.
Okay, this is George White. He reminded me of something important. It's not just the gym itself. It's not just the facility. It's the people there. It's the stories. It's the experiences we have. It's cool to me to think that somebody who lives in the UK, halfway around the world, has had an experience just like me. I know I'm not crazy. I know I'm not alone. There's a history to the gym, and I'm afraid that pretty soon the next generation isn't going to learn that history.
Where I train now is a chain gym, and it's like my son came back from China and he says, "Dad, I want you to teach me how to do weight training. I want you to teach me everything." So I took him to this gym and he says, "Dad, this is not the gym. This is not the gym you're going to teach me in." I went, "Right, okay." He wants to train in a proper gym. Good for you. So I took him to a gym called Muscle Works. Now, Muscle Works is probably one of the most famous gyms in Britain, and it's where loads of pro bodybuilders came about. And I go there maybe once a week.
Okay.
So I took my son, I put my arm around him. He says, "Look, it looks scary from the outside, but this is a real gym." And I took him there and he looked at it from the outside. "Dad, is this really a gym?" Because the sign was barred, the street was rough, there was the staircase was the most scary looking staircase. "Trust me, walk up this staircase and you're just going to love it." He says, "Are you sure, Dad?" So I took him up the stairs and it was like going into an Aladdin's cave to him. He says, "Wow, Dad, this is just amazing." And the guys behind the desk who were huge were friendly. I walked them through the gym and people, like, the strange thing is, if you go to a chain gym, nobody works in with you, nobody looks at you, nobody says hello to you, nobody spots you, nobody asks for a spot. It's like there's no soul to it. But in this place, you've got the scariest looking people in London, and they're all, "Oh, how you doing? Shall I move my weights out the way?" For me to show my son a real gym just opened his eyes to what training actually was. Now, if you ever get a chance to go to London, Muscle Works, that's the gym.
Something interesting to note here. I've talked to a lot of people on this project. Everyone that has a hardcore gym that they are proud of, they all want me to know the name. It doesn't matter if I live in a different state or even a different country. They want me to know the name of their gym. They're proud of it. I think it's really cool that George had an opportunity to show his son what a real hardcore gym was. It makes me wonder if this isn't an opportunity that not everybody will have in the future. I mean, these places are getting to be fewer and far between. If you've been going to the gym for a long time, then you know that the gym has a lot of unique personalities. A lot of the more extreme personalities have been pushed away. I've talked to a few people now who were too extreme to fit into modern gym culture. Basically, what I'm saying is, they were kicked out.
Well, it has to do with the big fitness trend.
I think back in the day, nobody like that would even go to a gym. And I don't know if you remember, but like the 90s, it would be all bodybuilders, powerlifters, bikers. If you didn't train that way, you looked weird. But that was a long time ago. Now it's just the opposite, you know.
Yeah.
You would get thrown out of the gym, by people that train hard mentally. You wouldn't come back. Mentally, you would be terminated. But, now it's just the opposite.
The people in bodybuilding, they need to be training as intense and as hard as humanly possible to make it.
If you don't make noise when you train, you didn't give it everything you had. I mean, it's just kind of, if you're not utilizing sight and adrenaline in that way, then you're falling short. It's not ballet.
I just think people don't think it's like normal to be screaming and cursing in a gym, and like to see them like sweating their asses off, like getting off like a leg press or doing what the squat set and just on the ground, just like in a lot of pain. People don't see that as being normal. They see it being as, what the hell are you doing? Why are you doing this to yourself? And we do it because we love it and this is what it takes.
Is that I could die if I don't. it could be potentially life ending. That's what, if you want to push beyond your capacity, that's basically how you got to look at it. Mentally, if you want to break a PR, that's kind of what it takes. You have to approach that set like it's life and death.
The way I train, I'm not going to change for you. This is what works for me. I'm going to keep doing it.
Okay, yeah, so both of these guys are quite extreme, and both of these guys were kicked out of gyms. Here's the thing, there's a lot of people that are not this extreme. They're new, and they're coming to the gym, and they're looking for direction. And they look at people like this, the people that are doing like the top end of everything they can, and they see these people getting kicked out of the gym. The gym is telling them that these people are wrong, and the culture is telling them that these people are wrong. Nobody wants to get kicked out of a place. So what does the newbie do? He just tries to like keep it cool, not get too extreme, stay moderate. What's that going to do for our sport? We have all these people that are just like not trying too hard. What's going to happen to bodybuilding?
I think I am on number 5 or 6.
Wow.
I've bought and sold many gyms.
This is Carl Jackson. Okay. He's owned several gyms over the past 20 years. Stintley was Michigan Barbell Total Fitness. Now he's involved with the Mind and Muscle Training Center in Clinton Township, Michigan. By the way, Mind and Muscle is awesome. Check it out.
90s, actually, it was very possible to own a hardcore gym and run one. Because back then the internet wasn't huge. So members bought items there. So they bought their supplements there. They bought their t-shirts there. They bought their gear there. So it was bringing extra revenue in. Whereas we didn't have to worry so much about, you know, how much we're charging our members. But with the advent of the internet and everybody looking for cheaper items, trying to save money, they started taking their money out of hardcore gyms. So when you leave a gym owner with nothing but memberships to pay, you know, rent and utilities and insurance and employees, it was a huge chunk. And, you know, with the advent of the internet and the popularity and buying online, it made it very difficult for small hardcore gyms to operate.
Why is it that when I go into a lot of what I'll call like the new mainstream fitness clubs that it seems like everything's going towards, I kind of get a feeling like I'm not really welcome there?
The problem is you're dealing with egos and people's self-esteem and issues like that. And what gyms have found over the years is that the more the gym members look like the average person, the more average person they're going to bring into the doors. You would think that would be the opposite. You would think people who are slightly more buff and in great shape would bring in more people because that's how people would want to look.
Sure.
But what we found is that it's an intimidating quality for them.
Hmm.
They come in, they see a whole bunch of buff people. It really grinds on their self-esteem because it took them a lot to get in the door in the first place.
Okay.
So that's why places like Planet Fitness, they have the Lark Alarm or whatever they do to keep the image a certain way. So they do high volumes of people. You're talking Planet Fitness will, you know, crank out 6,000 to 8,000 members, you know, and rotate them monthly. So in order to be able to do that, you can't scare or intimidate them away. So that's why that business model is prevalent right now. Back in the, you know, in the golden era, if you want to call it the 80s and 90s, we were more accepting of each other. We weren't as competitive in the gym. I know that's going to sound horrible, but in the gym, we all went to work out. We welcomed everybody. The camaraderie was amazing. You know, you'd work out and afterwards, a bunch of you would go hang out, you know, grab dinner afterwards. It was a community. We were a community. That entire community feel is gone. Now you have people with egos, meatheads, if you will, walking around and stringers and intimidating people or, you know, grunting and groaning and doing the whole alpha male, I'm a beast thing.
Yeah.
So you scare people. When you do that, nobody wants to compromise with you. Nobody wants to work with you. Nobody wants to be in your presence. So the attitudes of these, we never carried that I'm the shit attitude. You know, of course we had our ego, but we took it out in the weights. But, you know, we didn't have to daily, you know, say I'm this or that like people tend to do now with media. You just put yourself out there. But nobody knew who was going to a show until you got to the show. So, you know, but then you...
Are we to blame for our own destruction? Is bodybuilding taking itself out? Have we turned into something that is just kind of self-imploding? I hear so many people complain about what the internet has done and what social media has done to bodybuilding. And I see it. I see the egos. I mean, just look at your Facebook feed. It's not hard to figure out. So where are our priorities? There is money. There is money to be made in bodybuilding. If there wasn't, then people wouldn't be spending $60 on a tank top or buying a milk jug just because it says 5% on it. Come on, guys, it's a goddamn milk jug. But I refuse to believe that it's all our fault. I think that a lot of gyms started with good intentions. I think that's the case with the gym I go to. After a while, the owners get older, and they aren't as interested in bodybuilding as they used to be. But they still need to make money, and they realize they can do that more easily through the general public. I guess it's a lot easier to sell bodybuilding out when it's padded by a fat paycheck. You know, as you can see, I'm not just thinking about having a place where I can go to a gym and do something really cool. It's more than that. I'm thinking about bodybuilding as a whole. I'm thinking about its future. I'm thinking about how we're grooming the next generation. And I'm thinking about how we're telling people to just not try that hard. There's just something about that that doesn't sit right with me. And I don't feel like I've brought you anything new. I mean, we're 20 minutes into this thing, and I feel like we are exactly where we started. So let me give myself a minute here to take a breath, and let's bring on Ron Partlow. Ron is an IFBB pro, and he loves hardcore gyms. He loves hardcore gyms so much that he decided with his company Mutant to create a web TV show called Mutant on a Mission. It is so cool. Ron travels around the country and around the world to go to different hardcore gyms where he meets the people, he meets the owners, he trains there. Ron gets what I'm talking about. So let's cross our fingers that Ron can tell us just what the fuck is going on here. Because at this point, I feel like I've only raised more questions for myself.
It's funny how it came about. We were, I guess it would have been 2013, the Mutant team was down in Los Angeles and we were filming a bunch of content, you know?
Okay.
We just had a bunch of guys in all staying in a rented house. It was like a really nice mansion, and we were all, you know, barbecuing together and training together and shooting YouTube content, kind of bulk shooting, you know?
Okay.
And because Mutant, we don't really spend our money on advertising. You know, that's really expensive. So we'd rather put our money into, like, YouTube.
Yeah.
So we were down there shooting, and we were coming up with ideas. And I came up with an idea, and I pitched it to my boss. And I said, hey, you know, wouldn't it be cool if we just did a show on the gyms that we go to? Because at this point, you know, we'd gone to, you know, quite a few places traveling. I'd already done the circuit with Mutant one round. I'd already been to FIBO and Body Power, and we'd been around the world and, wow, you know, just been all over the place. And I sort of thought, you know, why don't we do a show on some of these gyms, you know? And he goes, well, what would you call it? And it came right out of my mouth. It just came right out because I just said Mutant on a Mission.
Nice.
It just came right out because it, you know, we already had products like Mutant Mayhem and Mutant Mass.
Yeah.
And it just alliterated itself, you know? And he looked at me and he goes, sounds expensive. and we kind of laughed, and that was it for a few months. And then about 6 months later, he called me up and he said, hey, we've got enough budget to do, you know, maybe 6 episodes.
If you guys haven't seen Mutant on a Mission, go check it out. This isn't just a plug for Ron. I mean, this stuff is super entertaining. Like I said, Ron travels all over the world to do these videos. He gives us an opportunity to see things that we might not get to see any other time. It's really a unique experience. And I feel like he really expresses what a hardcore gym means.
And I guess the main spark of this all was that when I started traveling with Mutant, I mean, I've been, you know, bodybuilding for such a long time, but when I started traveling with Mutant, I realized, you know, I started meeting a lot of young guys who were really big fans, you know, bodybuilding in general.
Right, right.
And I'd talk to them, and I don't know why I do this, but one of the things I always ask everyone is, where do you train? You know, so when people come to the booth and they shake your hand and take a photo with you, I always say, hey, where are you guys from? And they'll tell me, you know, I'm from, you know, Raleigh, North Carolina, or some random place. And I go, awesome. I go, where do you train? And
yeah.
I don't know why I asked them that. I just always do. And I found that all these young guys that were really into bodybuilding were saying, oh, I train at a, you know, a 24-hour fitness by my house, or an LA fitness by work. And I was thinking, man, there's really good gyms out there. Why don't you go find one? And I like, why don't these guys? And then I realized there's not a lot left.
Hmm.
And that's what really sparked the desire to do the show, is I want to show people what there is as an option to these places, and maybe motivate people to support these gyms more and make them aware that these gyms are, they're, you know, they might be 20 minutes away. You might have to drive, but man, they're worth it. You know, they'll welcome you. They want you there. They remember your name. You become part of the crew at the gym, part of the culture of the gym, instead of just, you know, member 3000 or whatever.
Yeah, yeah.
And I've always found the corporate gym to be just an inhumanly depressing situation. I never, ever have felt welcomed at one.
Hmm.
Even when I did train at a corporate gym for, you know, probably my maximum length would be maybe 1 year. I trained at a real corporate gym for 1 year just because of the situation of where I was living. And I, you know, I the staff there were nice, and they kind of let me do my thing, and they're, you know, but it was just never the same, you know? And, I just can't go back now. You know, I've spent my whole life, you know, planning where I was going to live and where I was going to work and who I was going to train with and all that stuff. I plan that stuff around what gyms there are in the area. And you know, I've bought and sold houses just to live close to a better gym. And I, you know, I fear that that's just not happening anymore. And these gyms need that to happen to stay alive. And I guess that was my motivation for it.
Okay. So it sounds to me like Ron is telling us it's our responsibility to keep these places alive. And it sounds pretty logical. If we want to keep these gyms going, then we need to go to them. We need to pay for memberships. We need to keep them running.
Let me ask you this. How do you think bodybuilding is being affected? Because you said, you know, you talk to a lot of these guys and they're training at like a big corporate place, a 24-hour fitness or whatever. How do you think that's affecting like the quality of this next generation of bodybuilders who might not have an opportunity to have seen like what you and I have seen at these really cool, you know, hole-in-the-wall gyms, these hardcore places?
Oh, the work ethic. I see it all the time. I see guys with far superior genetics than I had, far more opportunity. I mean, well, now we live in this age of endless social media promotional opportunity.
Sure.
So they have 10, they have 100 times the opportunity. They have far more knowledge is available to them, far more, far better coaching, far better information, far better access to supplements. And that includes anything else they're using is way easier to get. And yet the physiques aren't any better. And I really believe that it's tied to the fact that there's so many guys, you know, they're great bodybuilders in a lot of ways, but they're training at these gyms that are full of distractions and full of nonsense. The work ethic is suffering.
Yeah.
And I think that it's everything's too easy and too clean. You know, people are afraid to get dirty in a gym now.
Hmm.
Like, I remember having nosebleed squatting and just finishing the fucking set and not caring that there was blood all over the mat and all over the mirror. I was like, I'll wipe that off later. I'll be a good guy and I'll wipe that off. I'm going to clean my mess up. But, you know, nowadays, like you walk in these gyms, they look like showrooms. Like it almost gives you the subconscious feeling that you can't make a mess. And you walk into a lot of these gyms now and the radio's on, but it's on very low. So they want you to be quiet like a library. A lot of bodybuilders just can't get it through their heads that they're not fucking welcome there. Mm. They don't really want you there. They take your money and they smile at you. And the staff there might be nice people, but it's built into the fabric of the corporate gym that you're not wanted. There, a lot of people who train at these corporate gyms don't fucking realize that their business model is to have 10,000 members who do not ever come.
Okay.
That's their ideal business situation. They don't want you to come. They don't want you to use the equipment. They don't want you to flush the toilet. They don't want you to wear out any of the stacks or load any of the plates. They want an empty gym and they want to debit your account monthly. That is ideal situation. So I can't get on board with that. I don't want to go where I'm not welcome.
Yeah.
I don't want to go where people might be nice and they might be smiling, but the real owners of the gym wish I would leave. I don't want to be there.
Hmm.
I can't train there. And that's something that really means a lot to me. I can't give them my money.
Yeah.
And I don't know if it's just the stubborn old man in me or what it is, but you know, you go to a gym like Quads in Chicago or Dino's gym in England, or, you know, there are these fantastic gyms that we've taken our show to, you know, Diamond Gym in New Jersey. We just did an episode. You go to these fucking places and like these owners could not possibly love what they do more. They couldn't love their room more.
Right.
They couldn't love every member more. They appreciate every single dollar that every member spends there. And it's an atmosphere that if you've never experienced it, you're missing out. It reminds me of the very first gym I trained at, and maybe that's why I'm so stubborn about it. But there's just something about the fabric of a family-owned, you know, I mean, people call them hardcore gyms, but they're really family-owned gyms is what they are.
Yeah.
You know, it's the bodybuilders still make up a small percentage of these places. You know, people hear the term hardcore gym and they think it's a room full of juice heads or something.
Right.
But, you know, in reality, there's still only 5% bodybuilders there. But everyone else that is there is, you know, they love the loud music. Fuck, put on some AC/DC, Dino, you know, put on some fucking Metallica. Let's have some fun in here. And they're hooting and hollering. And you go to corporate gyms, you're not allowed to breathe heavy. You're not allowed to make a noise. And I get this, you know, the whole no yelling in the gym, no being an idiot, you know, you don't have to scream on your warm-up sets.
Right.
But man, let's have some fun. Do you ever go anywhere and have fun and not make any noise?
Hmm.
You know, you ever been to a concert? You ever go to a martial arts class? You ever been to a boxing gym? There's plenty of noise going on in a boxing gym. You know, it's that sort of thing. You know, guys are hooting and hollering, you know, before your set of squats, someone will yell across, "Let's see fucking 10 reps," you know, like Dino's gym has the best atmosphere I've been to in fuck maybe ever. you're going to get under the bar and you hear five voices screaming at you over the music. I want 10 fucking reps. Come on, buddy. Let's see it. You know, you don't even know who's yelling at you. And once you train in a place like that, I mean, you try to go back to LA Fitness or something. Fuck that. You know,
what can you tell the listeners here? Some of the younger guys who may not have had these experiences, how can we keep these places alive?
Well, first of all, if you train at a hardcore gym, don't be a dick and try to get in without paying your membership. That's one of the, you know, the funny, ironic thing about one of the things that kills these gyms is that everyone's a friend.
Mm.
Everyone, it's like a family. You know, you train there, you see the same guys every day because everyone goes every day.
Yeah.
So it's the opposite of the corporate gym, you know. You see the same people every day, so you get to know everyone. People stop scanning their card. People stop signing in. You wind up with half the gym training doesn't even have a paid membership.
Hmm.
And then these guys run the gym. They're trying to keep track of who's paid and who's not paid. And, you know, and when they start clamping down, people get mad and leave. Hmm. It's fucked up. You got to support the gyms. Quite often at these places, if they try to let me in free, I'll pay. Because it's a, I'm trying to make a point.
Nice.
I'm like, no, take my $20 fucking. Take it. I want you to have it.
Yeah.
It's, trust me, I can either spend $20 here or $20 going to some shitty movie, and I'd way rather give it to you.
Hmm.
You know, I train where I live. I train for free because, you know, I help promote the gym that I train at.
Okay.
I don't need to keep this $20, you know, pay for your drinks, pay for your shakes. You know, quit taking advantage of these gym owners because they're the last line of defense against a complete takeover. So, yeah, you know, just got to appreciate what you have. There's something about, you know, there's something about the sound of a guy squatting, you know, 3, 4, 5 plates. You know, even say 2 plates. Fuck, the average person doesn't squat 5 plates. It's just go down to 2, 3 plates.
Okay.
And you hear the jingle, you know?
Yeah.
The plates rattling. That noise to me is just, it's one of the best noises I've ever heard in my life. And, you know, you go to these gyms now where everything's nerfed and everything's rubber coated and everything's silent and you have to be quiet. And it drives me crazy. And I fear that the next generation of bodybuilders may not ever hear that sound.
Is there anything that I'm missing here? Cause this is something that it's developing as I go. And as I talk to people, am I missing a piece that we haven't talked about that you can think of?
Well, it's funny, you know, I don't quite understand, the divide between the corporate gyms mentality and what I actually see in the hardcore gyms, or the family owned gyms. The corporate gym has a mentality that everyone is offended by everything.
Yeah.
They take this ridiculous, it's like this regressive approach where if you make a noise, if you're too big, if you train too hard, if you start looking too crazy, there's this whole thing. I mean, we've seen people in the news that were asked to cover up but they're wearing the same clothing as 20 other people in the gym that aren't asked to cover up, you know?
Right.
We've all seen that article about the fit mom, everyone complaining about her tank top when all the other fat moms are wearing tank tops. So this whole sort of thing going on where you're not allowed to stick out, you're not allowed to do this stuff, but yet, at the family gyms, the hardcore gyms, I don't see any of that. I see the regular mom and dad members and you know, the grandma and grandpa members too. I mean, there's 65-year-old, 75-year-old people training at these hardcore gyms too. They don't ever complain about that stuff. They're coming up going, man, you guys are training hard. I love it. Yeah. I've had old ladies come up to me at these gyms and say, you guys are really giving her, you know?
Yeah.
Stuff like that. And I fucking love that stuff. And I don't know if it's just the people that are different or if it's an inaccurate picture that corporate has of what people think. I don't know why there's such a divide. Why am I offensive in their gym, but yet with 65, 70-year-olds at another gym, they love it. They love what's going on. They love seeing us work. I don't know why there's – what's the difference between the 70-year-olds? Is there – you know what I mean?
I do. I know exactly what you're talking
about. I don't quite
about.
Understand why corporate thinks that. And then even at some of the corporate gyms I've trained at, you know, I've made plenty of friends with some of the older people that are there. You know, they think what we're doing is cool. Yeah. You know, man, you guys are moving a lot of weight on that machine today, you know, that sort of stuff.
Yeah.
And I have – I think that part of the problem – now, I don't want to lay all the blame on the corporate gyms or any of that. Part of the problem is the bodybuilder's fault.
Okay.
And it's that I see a lot of bodybuilders that don't talk to anybody when they go to the gym. And they have the right idea. They're trying to get in there and train. But you got to remember that when you look like a bodybuilder, you are, whether you like it or not, an ambassador for bodybuilding everywhere you go. Hmm. And it's not something that you have to embrace. You can just come and go as you please. That's fine. But don't expect it to make anything better. And my whole life, I've always felt like I wanted to talk to people. So, you know, when I'm done my workout, I'll spend 10 minutes chatting with the guy at the front desk or asking the girl, hey, you know, how many members you got here?
Yeah.
Hey, like, how long has this gym been open? You know, I don't know. I'm just curious that way. I wind up having conversations with members, conversations with people coming in the door, you know, chatting with people. I'm kind of social that way at those gyms. And I think that if everyone did a little bit of that, it would, even at the corporate gyms, if everyone did a little bit of that at the corporate gyms, it would help. But I don't know. There's not enough of us. You know, the bodybuilding is such a small thing. They're never going to cater to us.
Okay, so I get it. It is partially our fault. I think that we have become victims of convenience. I mean, we can go up to the corner and there's going to be an LA Fitness in a lot of cities, just a couple miles from you. You might have to travel a little bit further to get to a good gym. But all of us, and I guess that includes me too, we need to think about this. We need to think about what life would be like without these places. What if all we had were these big commercial box facilities? There are some great gyms left out there, so support them. Don't let them slip away. I'd like to thank everybody that contributed to this episode. Thank you to George White. Thank you to Scott Hughes, Jake Petchon. Thank you to Carl Jackson. Carl coaches at Team Juggernaut and is available at the Mind and Muscle Training Center in Clinton Township, Michigan. And of course, special thanks to Big Ron Partlow. You can find Ron all over the net. Check out IamMutant.com. Go to Project Bodybuilding and hear him on All Bull Radio. And of course, if you haven't seen them yet, you have to go to YouTube and watch Mutant on a Mission. Up next, Chuck Zarowski and I answer listener questions, so stick around. This program has been presented by Naps Gear. Welcome back to Advices Radio. Advices Radio is presented by Naps Gear. This is episode 12. I'm Scott, your host, and I'm back again with Chuck Zarowski. What's happening, Chuck?
Good. How is everything, Scott? You doing well?
Yeah, I'm doing really good, man. How about yourself? How's training and everything?
Good. Training's fun. I just started training this guy named Tony. He goes by Dwayne or Tony, both names, but he's a genetic freak. Like, he's big wide guy. He's probably about 5'9", at least probably 240, and he competes in powerlifting, but his bench has been lagging. Yeah. And so, like, I trained with him yesterday for the first time, and I kind of got an idea of where he's weak at and where he needs to overcome. And then if we can work that area, this guy's going to be a 4-450 bencher easy.
Nice, man.
So I'm excited to work with him. He's just got, like, you know, like I was telling you before, like, you get these people that are like genetic freaks and then, like, they don't have the direction. Well, just that little bit of push in the right direction.
Yeah.
It's fun to work with him.
Yeah, that's pretty cool, man. I've never benched 450 in my life, but I mean, strength has never been my goal, but there's so much about technique. I know that's so important to you guys in powerlifting. So much about technique that I don't understand, man. It's fascinating to me.
It's honestly really a really cool study in biomechanics. It's biomechanics and leverage. That's all it is.
Okay.
And so it's like shortening the distance. It's almost like the more upper, like, let's say you're going to bench press. The more upper back that you have, the less that bar has to move. the bigger chest you have or stomach you have or better arch you have, the least, the bar doesn't have to move quite so far. If your arms are bigger, if your biceps are bigger, your triceps are bigger, it supports more weight. You can actually, you're limiting your range of motion. The bar has less room to move. Same thing with squatting. Like, the wider you squat, the less that bar has to move, the less your knees have to move. It's pretty interesting. It's just biomechanics, but you're just doing leverages and biomechanics. Nice. And then the neat thing is you can analyze kind of like where let's say like you're looking at deadlift and you got somebody that's kind of built like me. I'm very short. I got long arms and I've got a strong lower back. So my conventional deadlift is pretty good. You know, like a deadlift where your feet are kind of more narrow.
Right.
Whereas somebody who has like wider hips has like maybe shorter arms. Like usually a sumo deadlift is pretty good for him. But so it's kind of like so much, you know, how like bodybuilding's art where you can kind of like figure out what kind of like what you want to sculpt. It's kind of like that in powerlifting too. There's an art to it because you figure out where your leverages are, what's right for you, and then you work with that. So it's pretty cool. How's your back doing, man?
Oh, it's 100% better now. I don't know why it went out to begin with, but now it is come back around. So I can't complain. You know, I'm living life again and training pretty much as usual. So I can't complain, man. It's good.
Did you have to roll out of bed that first day?
Oh, yeah. I roll out of bed every day. Who are you kidding?
I know. All I do is I try and get my belly girth to kind of like rotate to the left, and then it just pulls me.
That's funny, man. I just had an opportunity to talk to Jordan Peters, and he's pushed 300 pounds in the past. It amazes me, you know, to think about carrying that kind of mass. And the question that always comes up to me in my mind is the fact that you have to believe you can be a certain weight before you can be it. And honestly, I can't imagine what it feels like to be 300 pounds. You know, it's a lot of weight to carry around. I know that for me, just at 220, it can be uncomfortable at times. So, you know, I can imagine getting to 230, and that's what the goal is. But 300 pounds, and it's you're a whole different human being at that point.
I have a great friend. His name's Bill Tarango. And Bill used to post on the Elite Fitness boards, like back when Elite was real big.
Yeah.
He was monster. So I don't know. He used to write some fantastic posts. He's really, really smart. But Bill was like 5'10", and he went around 320, 315.
Wow.
And he was like, and that's what he carried. But he carried it well. And like he had massive legs and a massive ass and just massive back. Everything on Bill was big. But, you know, he would carry it like well. But then, you know, like you or I, like I'm 220 right now, like 215, 220. And like tying my shoes is hard, or like I can't bend my legs. You know, I don't have flexibility in my legs. So just to kind of put my leg over my other, like to tie my shoe.
Yeah.
I mean, that's difficult. So
it's uncomfortable
usually
sometimes. Yeah.
Yeah. I look for stairs. Stairs, because, you know, you can put like 1 foot down on the stair and then try to tie it. I'm kind of thinking about Velcro now.
Yeah. So,
but it's hard to believe like you can walk around 300 pounds comfortable.
Yeah, yeah. So it's just something to keep in mind, guys. If you want to be 300, you got to believe that you can be 300. That it's the lesson for the day. Let's move on, though. We got a bunch of questions here. So let's jump in, tackle them, see what we can come up with for the guys.
Sounds good.
First question here is actually not from a guy. This is from a gal. And she says, I'm 25 years old, female, and I did my first figure competition in April.
Congratulations. Congratulations, by the way.
Yeah. My diet and training are on point, and I'm wanting to start my first cycle of Anavar. Although I trust my source, I understand that Anavar is commonly cut with Deanabol. In order to avoid looking like a member of Duck Dynasty, what are some of the indicators that my VAR is actually D-Ball or another commonly substituted drug so that I can immediately stop use? Thank you. Yeah, this is a terrifying question, I think, for females to have to deal with. I mean, you know, you and I have talked before in the past about, you know, just the fear of putting unknown substances into your body in general. As a male, that's one thing. Hormones for a female, as we've discussed, can be totally different.
And irreversible.
Absolutely. you know, I would say that, you know, A, definitely, it really comes down to having a good source. I would say that even if you say trust the person, I know I've seen situations where there's people who are, you know, underground distributors, and that they have their own labs, or there's, you know, underground labs in town that, that people get the powders, they make the products, they sell the stuff. And even if you really trust the person, they may not have the best source for their raw materials. So that's a consideration right there. So it might not even have to do with how much you trust the person you're getting it from. This person could be getting duped too. So, I mean, you could have it tested. There is, I think Bill Llewellyn now has a very crude test called the Royd test, and it will give you a color indication if the product contains said compound. It doesn't give you the actual milligrams of it, but it will let you know whether it's that or whether it's something else. You know, we've discussed on Bodybuilding Nerds where we had used that test, and we discovered a company that I believe is now out of business. I'm going to call them out too. D-Labs, they were selling Anavar that actually turned out to be Winstrel. And I find that to be just a low down, filthy, dirty thing to do. And the problem is that drugs like Anavar or Primobolan are much more expensive. Exactly. So, you know, number one, if you get it from a pharmacy, that would be the way to go. They do make pharmaceutical Anavar is available. So, you know, obviously that would be the number one direction to go. You know, outside of that, my only fear is that if you were taking Dianabol, you wouldn't know that there was a problem until it was too late.
Absolutely.
You know, you see a lot of the side effect profiles that you read about these drugs on the internet, and you'll see side effects for Anavar are very mild. And one of the things you're not going to read is, you know, some of the stuff that can happen to women can be different than to men. I've seen pharmaceutical Anavar that's given women some bloating. I mean, I've seen the same thing with Winstrel. So if you know, and this is something that it shouldn't happen, you know, theoretically, you know, these things are DHT derived compounds and there should be no real bloat with them. I've seen it happen to females and I have no idea what the mechanism is, but I'm pretty certain that the drugs were what they said they were. But at the same time, you can get some fluid retention.
A lot of times it has to do with like we talked about last week, our own biochemistry. Everybody's different and we're going to react to different things. We're going to react to things differently. Like maybe I can metabolize, my liver is able to metabolize Tylenol pretty easily. Maybe somebody else's isn't.
Yeah,
so it has to do with that, a lot of that stuff too, like how the metabolite gets accrued in the system. It's just how your body works.
Yeah. So, but regardless of, you know, the fake or the bad stuff that's out there, there is good products. I've seen things like I said, pharmaceutical grade obviously is going to be legit as long as it's from the pharmacy. You know, brands like Geneza Pharmaceuticals, there's a lot of them out there that are good products that are available, but definitely, you know, do your homework and seek those out. But do you have any other thoughts you'd like to add on this one, Chuck?
No, I just think, like you said, like in the very beginning, it's terrifying for a female because, like, you want to get, like, if you're going to take Anavar, you're going to take it because, you know, Anavar is mild. It's, you know, it works on creatine phosphate too. So it's, you know, it'll harden you up and it's just, you know, it's a really, really cool drug and it's a milder drug. But the fact that you have to worry about putting something like a heavy androgen in your body as a woman, and then the changes that can be irreversible, that's got to be difficult. It's hard to fathom.
Yeah, absolutely, man.
So,
next question. This is similar to something we had asked before. This guy's running a cycle and he wants to know how to combat insulin resistance while he's on it. This sounds like something that is more in your field, Chuck. What are your thoughts from a medical perspective on combating insulin resistance?
Well, honestly, the insulin resistance is essentially, you hear about people in type 2 diabetes. Essentially, type 2 diabetes is just insulin resistance. It happens a lot with age. It happens a lot when sometimes you might be eating a lot of sugar your whole life, and your body just keeps eliciting insulin. And then after a while, your islet cells can be kind of like, they can be almost blown out. The islets can be blown out. Your pancreas might not be working properly. After a period of years, our body becomes like a car. After working for so many years, things start breaking down. And one of the things that breaks down is, our insulin sensitivity. The cool thing that you got, that everybody that's probably listening to this radio show has going for them, is exercise acts like insulin. Okay, whenever you like exercise, what happens is you take in more of that the insulin. You take in more of the sugar, and it goes inside your muscle cells. And exercise acts as insulin. I had a really cool pathophysiology teacher that used to stress that.
Okay.
So just exercising makes you less insulin resistant. Other things that I've heard that have been, useful. There's certain glucose disposal agents that you can use. I mean, I don't really like insulin, to be honest with you, but it's just, that's insulin. You have a little less room for error, in my opinion, on insulin,
yeah.
Especially if you don't know how to use it right, if you don't know how to get it, that type of stuff. So go ahead. I'm sorry. What were you going to say?
I was just going to add that it's not going to fix insulin resistance either.
Absolutely not. There's certain things that can help, like R-alpha lipoic acid, the R enantiomer of alpha lipoic acid. Works really well as a glucose disposal agent. So it kind of shuttles into your muscles pretty quickly. It helps with insulin resistant. I know they've done some studies on R alpha lipoic acid to help out with they've done it with people that are diabetic.
Okay.
And they've used R alpha lipoic acid to get people off glucophage, metformin, that type of a thing. Because glucophage and metformin have a tendency, which are drugs for type 2 diabetes, they have a tendency to give you like really weird fatty distribution areas.
Really? I didn't know
this. They do. And they're also known to really affect the stomach. So you get people can get diarrhea pretty well. It's called lipodystrophy. Glucophage and metformin can cause lipodystrophy.
No, I never heard of that.
Yeah. So as far as for like insulin sensitivity for me, I mean, honestly, you're going to reduce your carbs a little bit, kind of decrease the work that the pancreas has to do. The pancreas has to create has to work whenever you got a lot of sugar in you. And after over a period of time, it can burn out. So decreasing sugar helps insulin sensitivity, particularly, simple sugar. The other thing, too, like R-alpha lipoic acid is good, but in my opinion, exercise is one of the best things you can do for insulin resistance.
Yeah, I agree. There's other stuff that I've seen work.
Like what?
Berberine HCL. That's a good glucose disposal agent. I've seen it work similar to metformin, but without the side effects.
Mm-hmm.
Drawback is I've also seen it not work at all,
sure.
even from the same place. I think that there's issues with bioavailability for some
right.
people. So for the people that it works well for, it works. But for the people that don't digest it properly, they don't mm-hmm. seem to get an effect. It can be kind of pricey to use. The dosing is around 1,500 milligrams a day,
okay.
split into three doses. If you're using it at that dose, it could get kind of pricey, over the long haul. But, if it works for you, it is definitely, well worth it. So it'd be worth trying out, see, how things look. You could even test your blood sugar, couldn't you, Chuck?
And Absolutely. Get a one touch. A lot of times you can get an insurance company. Like, let's say if you have some insulin resistance, if you think you're type 2 and your doctor says that you're type 2, you can get insurance to get you a glucometer. The strip, and that'll be free. The strips cost a lot of money.
Yeah.
But you can actually get a glucometer and just test your blood sugar. It's not a bad idea. I also know that some of the R-alpha lipoic acid, some of those, what they do is they rotate. They have an R and an S side. It's almost like amino acids have an L and a D side. Okay, so it's just the way that the enantiomer is twisted around the chiral center. So a lot of times if you get a substandard R-alpha lipoic acid, it's not going to work. It's actually going to work. it's going to have like a mixture, a racemic mixture of like R and S in it, in which case it doesn't work quite so well. So you need a decent, the best, and I'll give a shout out to this company.
Yeah, please do.
Anafit has a product out called Glucarol.
Okay.
And in my opinion, it's the best R-alpha lipoic acid on the market. It's fantastic. And I've known people that have taken it and actually dropped their blood sugar so low that they've needed sugar because, you know, they've actually dropped their blood sugar because of it. So, you know, I think it's just an outstanding product. I really do. And I think it's good for life extension because, you know, you figure it's an antioxidant, right, but it's both, you know, it's both water and fat soluble. So, you know, you're using antioxidants, you know, we know what our antioxidants do. Free radicals cause, like, you know, free radicals will take an electron from a, you know, an electron from a cell. And what it'll do is it'll cause this big chain reaction where this electron will pull away from another one and this electron can pull away from another one. And basically it's causing some cellular death. But antioxidants kind of add those electrons, and they're both fat soluble and water soluble. So you need kind of both of them. Yeah. So vitamin C is a water soluble antioxidant. Vitamin E or D is a fat soluble. So it's kind of like you need both of them, but our alpha lipoic acid does a really good job of that too. Ammonia, okay. It's a good ammonia scavenger from what I understand too.
All right. Next question. This guy's, he says he's a fan of the show, and he's also listened to Bodybuilding Nerds, so thanks, I appreciate it. His question is about GH. He says he's 43 years old now, and he has used steroids off and on at moderate doses, 500 to 800 milligrams a week, test base. After trying peptides for a while, I took a break and then decided to try HGH. I liked the recomposition that occurs and thought maybe this would help me add a bit more muscle. And honestly, I believe moderate dosing is probably more positive than negative. I am on 3 IU a day, first thing in the morning, as I am largely dosing it for recomposition and some muscle building. I do train in the morning as well. What I am noticing, though, is a lot of swelling. This started about 3 weeks in, around the knees and ankles. I've had some in the ankles before, just with steroid use, but the knees is a new one to me. I did read that this may be a result from GH, but it may mitigate after a while, so I'm debating on sticking it out. But if it doesn't go away, I think I have to think twice about continuing. Swollen knees is not cool, and usually by the afternoon, this starts up. No pain, really, but this is not attractive. My height is 188 centimeters, and I weigh about 220 pounds at probably 9 to 10% body fat, as I try to eat very clean and do fast as well during the week. Any thoughts on this? I know I'm water retention prone, but this is bizarre. Okay, that was a big question, but I understand where he's going with this. It sounds like he's just a few weeks in, so my suggestion would probably be to back off the dose and see if your body gets used to it that way. I know some people just have a harder time than others with water retention. I have a good friend, if you've listened to BNR, you've heard this, that he will bloat up like crazy even on one unit of growth. So it's unfortunate for him, but he has a hard time with it. Some people are going to get more water retention than others from it. But the key is to start very, very low. And if you have to, even take like a half a unit and give it a couple of weeks at a half a unit and then go to one unit. And at least that's how I would personally handle this. And that's what I've heard other people to have success with, and to continue giving yourself, you know, 2 weeks at a time and increase a half a unit as you go. And hopefully this will mitigate the problem. Chuck, do you have any idea what fluid retention is caused by from GH use?
I do not. I do not. The side effects that I know from GH are like the worry of GH for me is more like, it's actually making yourself diabetic. Sure, I worry because GH can do that. But as far as for water retention, I don't know, Scott.
Yeah, it's something I've seen. And like I said, some people have it more than others, but the key is, you know, there's a potential that just having gone up to 3 units really quick like that, that your body's just responding, you know, negatively like this. I found that over time, though, the fluid retention does level out. And so definitely back the dose down and try to slowly build.
You've seen this. Have you seen this in other people before previously?
Oh, yeah. Okay. It's super common. Yeah. Next question. There seems to be a lot of bodybuilders who are on HRT. Do you think that is because they permanently have damaged their HPTA? I'm just finishing my first 9-week cycle of 400 milligrams of test per week, and I'm wondering if there is any science or bro science regarding how much or how long you have to be on gear to do permanent damage, or what percent of users end up going on HRT. Thanks and love the show. All right, man. This is one where I think you could probably jump in with some good science, Chuck.
Well, to be honest, I've never in my life ever seen anybody completely shut down from taking steroids.
Really?
Or taking gear. I've never in my life like had somebody completely shut themselves down that I know of. I've had people that have it taken a while to recover, PCT wise and that type of a thing, but I've never known anybody to completely shut down. No. I've known where, because basically your body's just like, you're giving yourself endogenous hormones. And so your body's like going, okay, well, I don't have to produce so much. Well, if you don't have to produce so much, okay, that's one thing. But when you stop taking the endogenous hormone, taking PCT, getting your stuff started again, your Leydig cells going again, I just don't know anybody that's completely shut themselves down. I don't personally know.
Okay, so completely or, but you, just because
I've known people
not completely
that have...
Yeah, you see where I'm going with this. Just because someone's not completely shut down or completely permanently shut down, mm-hmm. I have seen damage that doesn't look like it's going to recover even after a couple of years.
I have too, but I've never, like I said, like anecdotally or just personally, I've never known anybody to shut themselves down completely. That's from my experience. As far as for HRT goes, you need a reputable doctor that's going to do your blood work. You need somebody that's going to do lab work on you and find out where your test levels are. And test levels have a baseline over a period of time, too. Because, like, you can take one point in time and your test levels can be, like, you know, incredibly high. And then a couple weeks down the road, they can be incredibly low. So you need to make sure you get somebody that's got a good, reputable doctor that's going to test your levels and find out, like, what they are.
Okay. And he's asking, too, one of his big things here is he's kind of wondering – how long can he be on cycle before he's going to damage himself? And the answer to that is, we don't know.
Variable. Yeah, everybody's different.
So, I mean, the thing is that I could speak out of my own experience. The first cycle I ran, I recovered very well from. But then after I came off of that, I did the post-cycle therapy, and I was eager to get back on. And although I did wait an extended period, I don't know if I totally 100% recovered because I didn't do my lab work. I didn't know at the time. And I did another cycle. I kept repeating this process. And the periods of time off grew slowly smaller. The periods of time on, the gear went slightly up. You know, each cycle, this is a probably common story. I think that this is the story of somebody who's used anabolics. And at the end of the day, if you continue, it's not the one cycle that's gonna really do it. I think at least for me, it's the continuous on and off extended periods of using and then not having given yourself enough time to totally recover.
I agree. And then you have people that'll be on for years and that just, you know, cruise at 200 HRT, and basically what their body's doing is depending on that HRT in order they're not depending on their body to make it. They're depending on some like exogenous source of the hormone to make its own test. So, I mean, after a while, your body's like, hell, I don't have to do it anymore. I don't have to make it. But I think a good thing to do though is it's just like a bar graph or like a plot graph where you have to get your lab work done in a series to make sure to see where your lab work is, because, you know, lab work varies. You just need to make sure to get like you know, lab work done, 6 weeks, another 6 weeks, another 6 weeks. Find out where you're at and find somebody reputable that will do that, that you trust.
Because what you're getting at here is that one lab test is not going to give you the be-all yep. end all. You know, it's not a story at that point. It's just one snapshot.
Good analogy. Absolutely. It's like we'll get some doctors that will get one lab result and go haywire over it. And like I talked about in the past, you need kind of like a picture.
Yeah.
You need a picture.
So as far as it goes, hopefully he did labs before he started this first cycle, because then ideally before he begins his next cycle, he'll be able to do lab work again. He'll be able to compare those two sets of labs and he'll see that his test has recovered before he begins that next one.
I think it's a good, I hope he did. And if he didn't, when you come off and you do your PCT, if this is your first cycle, chances are you'll recover. Then when you go on again, get your lab work done, get your blood work done, find a baseline somewhere where you know is baseline. And if you drop from that baseline level, then, you know, you're shutting yourself down.
Okay. Next question is, what are your thoughts on home brewing? What do they teach you about that in medical school, Chuck?
Don't do it.
did they specifically say don't homebrew your gear, bro?
Yeah, absolutely. It was like some big musclehead was like, "Don't brew it, bro. Here, take the real shit."
Yeah.
No, but
I mean, okay, let's talk theoretically here. You could make some great stuff. Yeah, that mm-hmm. would be possible. But, you know, let's look at some other things. Now, if you're in a country where this is legal, let's say you live in China and you can legally own these hormones and you have the science to understand how to do everything and a sterile facility, then, you know, laboratory or something, then go for it. But you know what? If you live in a country where it's illegal to purchase these raw materials and you don't know exactly where they're coming from, because see, that's the issue. That's a big issue there. You could have a great production system set up for your own home use of this stuff, but you know what? You're just getting a bag of powder, and it could be anything unless you have the ability to test this stuff, which I doubt you do. You know, you don't know what you're getting. So, I mean, the big companies out there are hopefully the good companies that we depend on, the good companies that I've depended on in my history, were companies that, you know, obviously had good connections and they knew where to get this stuff or they knew where to manufacture it. And they were doing it in places where it was, you know, totally legal and safe to do. So a lot of times guys who are home brewing are doing it in countries where it's not legally readily available. So that's the A side of it, and the B side of it. And I guess there's a C side too. So let me go to B, which is still on the legal note. I mean, if you were producing this stuff in a country where it was illegal to do, then not only are you in possession of an illegal substance, but now you also are manufacturing it, and that's going to be a much stiffer penalty. But then C, and this is just as important, is, you know, health and safety and the sterility of your products that you're using. So, you know, as awesome as it sounds, I would say leave it to the experts. And, you know, as far as it goes, man, there's a lot of companies out there that basically are home brewed. And I would suggest that you stay away from those companies too. So with all, you know, all these issues that can come up, man, just go the safe route. I mean, on this topic, abscesses. If you've ever seen a picture on the internet of what an abscess looks like, it will make you think twice. Chuck, have you ever seen an abscess in your line of work?
Oh my God, yeah. Like, you know, I used to work in an inner city ER, and like you would get people that were heroin addicts, or you would get people that were drug users and IV drug users. I've seen people get peripheral vascular disease and lose legs.
Jeez.
I've seen people come in and say, look, you know, I was shooting up, but can you take a look at this? And then open up a bandage and there's just pus coming right out of it.
Oh my God.
I've seen a lot of it. And the worry is, it's not just that localized area. The worry is like that, now that infection that's in that little pus packet, that's like, you know, let's say you get a small infection on your skin and, you know, it's a little bit painful, right? The worry is that infection goes systemic. And if that infection goes systemic, you can get sepsis and die. I mean, sepsis has like a 70% mortality rate. I mean, it's if you go full blown sepsis, you are going to die. But the worry is like it just going systemic. So like if you do, if and I think I've mentioned this before, but let's say you do everything you can and you get an abscess and you get like it's a swollen area and it's painful and it's red and it hurts, or there might be some pus, or there could be something like, you know, a smell, or it could be like, you know, a yellowish type liquid coming out of it.
I'm about to throw up over here.
Well, for by any stretch of the imagination, go see your doctor. Go see your doctor, get some antibiotics from them. A lot of people tend to say, oh, I got some antibiotics laying around. My mom does that shit.
Yeah.
She'll like, she won't take her full run of antibiotics, but always take your full run of antibiotics, take them until they're gone, and then go to the doctor and let them know. Like, even, it might be embarrassing and it might be something you might not want to talk about, but, you know, it's better than losing a leg.
Yeah.
Or it's, you know, so just, and then the other thing I've stressed before, a septic technique, you know, wipe everything off. Make sure everything is sterile, because, like, for any shot or for anything that you're going to do, like, by all means, don't share needles. You know, use it one time, throw it away.
Yeah, I don't think most bodybuilders, we probably don't have to preach that to most bodybuilders.
I know.
But I have heard kids, younger guys who apparently don't have access to needles, and they've asked questions like, can I use it again? Or
no,
you know, yeah, that, at the cost, the price of the stuff, you either afford to do it and you take the responsibility to do it right and do it safe, or you just don't do it at all because you're obviously not responsible enough.
Absolutely. Just, you know, like you always hear that, and it's just things that you want to stress. Just, you know, just be careful, guys. That's all.
Yeah, absolutely. All right, last question. Ooh, this is a training question. How do I bring up my biceps? Chuck, we've been talking about all this drug stuff and ER thing topics. Let's switch gears here. I want to hear what you have to say about some bicep growth.
All right, back to my topics. Right, I like right. this. They used to say, like, in powerlifting, tries are for guys, curls are for girls. But because, I mean, honestly, got like in powerlifting, we only do biceps just to try and, like, basically we do it to try and keep, like, some sort of, like, harmony between the synergistic muscle groups.
Yeah.
And you need it for grip and all that stuff. But to be honest, and I've seen this more times than not, and this is just, it's kind of funny. So when I'm training when I'm doing back, I'm pulling with my biceps, right? And then I'm doing chins, I'm pulling with my biceps. And then I'm doing any sort of grip movement, like I'm usually pulling with my biceps. I'm doing bent over rows, T-bar rows, dumbbell rows. I'm pulling with my biceps. And what happens is, like, we'll do like a separate day for it. And then we'll do another day that's just for arms. And then we'll do like a chest tricep day or a chest whatever shoulder day.
Right.
And then we'll do that same day for arms. So we're creating arms 4 days a week.
Yeah.
A lot of times, and this is counterintuitive, a lot of times we're overtraining the shit out of our arms. We're overtraining particularly the bicep, because the triceps are more fast twitch muscles. Okay. Your triceps are like, they're explosive muscles. They're used to pushing away. A lot more weight can be used pushing than pulling. So a lot of times we tend to just continually, like, man, my biceps are lagging. I'm going to keep working them. And I think a lot of times we overtrain them. And so, like, whenever I see bodybuilders that, like, work the shit out of their arms and can't get a lot of arm growth, for about 2 weeks I tell them not to work their biceps directly.
Right.
And a lot of times they'll grow because basically they're just never recovered. And so, like, I mean, let your body get a chance to recover and then hit it again and stimulate it. Like, wasn't it Lee Haney that said, stimulate, don't annihilate?
Yes, it was.
All right. So I think that's true. I think that's totally true, because I think we tend to overtrain arms a little bit. And so there's a guy at Powerhouse Novi, and I think he's an awesome guy, and he's got an awesome physique. But he's so massive that his arms are probably 19 inches, but his biceps and his triceps, particularly his biceps, don't match his triceps. And it could be a, like, you know, a genetic kind of thing, but I think he hits them too hard all the time.
Is he a client of mine by chance?
I'm not sure. All right. I'm not sure. But he tends to hit them so often that, like, you know, he's always talking, I'm doing arms. But I'm like, I told him one time, dude, you just lay off the arms for a couple of weeks. And, he won't do it. But I think the other thing, too, is it has all to do with, like where our tendons are. And I think it has where our leverages are. Because some people may have, you know, some people may have attachments that are lower on their biceps. Some people may have attachments that are higher. Yeah. That's just how they are. But I think like, you know, some people don't benefit from barbell curls. Like, I could never benefit from barbell curls.
Yeah.
Like, but a standard dumbbell curl is pretty good. A lot of times they say to keep your wrist straight when you're doing a curl. Reason being is it keeps the weight a little bit back more, and so you can hit the biceps just a little bit harder. I know some people have tried to actually bend their wrist, but I don't agree with that. I think like gripping the wrist dumbbell as hard as you can and then pulling it up. Also, like, it's the movement of your arms too. Like, some people tend to, like, when they're doing a basic dumbbell curl, they have a tendency to bring their elbows forward, and like forward meaning like forward in front of their body.
Yeah.
Just the only thing you want to move is your forearm. Your forearm is the hinge, and so that's what you want to move. You want to keep your – and then, you know, like, I think, like, your big mass builders, the more weight you can put on a bar, I think, is better than, you know, whatever. But I always have wrist problems, so I can't do barbell curls.
Yeah, I can't – you know, when you said, like, grip the bar as hard as you can, mm-hmm. I have to do the opposite of that for me.
Hey, really?
I get terrible tendonitis if I grip a bar mm-hmm. too tight. You know, all the little accessory tendons and everything, that it mm-hmm. all gets all overworked. Everything that's like assisting my grip. So I end up getting, bad tennis elbow to the point where I can't grip anything anymore. So
is that from squatting, or is that from like, I guess, in totality of your training, or is that just when you grip heavy on dumbbell work?
Or
barbell work?
Just if I grip heavy, or I'm sorry, just if I grip really tight in general. Okay. I found that for me, I want to try to keep my grip as loose as possible, and I'll use like a wrist wrap for any of my pulling activities. Mm-hmm. Obviously, there's points when you're lifting heavy that you have to grip it. You know, you mm-hmm. have to hold on. But I definitely, I have problems if I try to grip a bar as hard as I can.
See, I get problems whenever, like, I don't have problems when I'm gripping for, you know, deadlifting or anything like that. I have problems when I squat because
really?
the squat will give me bicep tendonitis. Yeah.
Weird.
Because it's just the way that you're locked. Your elbows are kind of locked behind you.
Yeah.
And so, like, by locking them, you tend to brace the biceps pretty hard, and that will give me tendonitis. Like, I can't, like, I have to bench. Like, if I'm in my stuff or in my programming, I have to program benching before I squat. So the day before I squat or the day before I squat, I can bench, but I can't do it vice versa.
Okay.
The other thing is too, is like, there's a book out called, I think it's Power to the People by Pavel Tatsulini. I don't know if you've ever heard him. He's the guy that brought the kettlebells to the United States.
Okay.
Okay. But he has in his book, he always talks about stressing and gripping everything as hard as you can.
Hmm.
Obviously, with your problems with the tendonitis, stay away from that, obviously. But he talks about, because if I grip something loosely, if I grip something kind of loose, okay, fine, I can do the exercise. But if I grip tight, because you were talking about all those accessory muscles, so everything's tight in my grip. So everything will be tighter, like proximal to the body. So if my abs are braced very tightly, I've got like good air and I'm gripping hard, my whole body will be able to react. So that's he has a theory about that. That's all.
I see.
I'm not saying it's correct. I'm just saying that a theory.
And I see how that makes sense too for functional strength and for powerlifting
but people that have problems, like your bicep tendonitis and whatnot.
Yeah.
I mean, you have to work around that. That's what you have to do, because sure. if you just do what a book says, hey, you know, I can do whatever a book says, but if I'm aching, I'm probably not, if my hips are aching, I'm probably not going to squat that day, or even though my program says to, I'm probably not.
So just to kind of throw in a couple of my thoughts here, and then we'll close the show out.
Mm-hmm.
You know what? I can't really comment on having great biceps because I'd have to say that for me, biceps are one of my weaker body parts. They definitely don't stand out for me. And part of that is just the way my arms are designed. My attachments on my biceps aren't great. They are kept up. They are in line with the rest of my physique. They're not an outstanding body part. But as far as developing them goes, I found that it's something that you hit on, Chuck, that my arms are going to get worked hard with heavy weight while I'm doing my back work. Mm-hmm. So what I end up doing a lot of times is I find success when I have an arm day not going as heavy. I don't use crazy heavy weights on my barbell curls. I go for, you know, like I'm never going for like 6 reps on barbell curls. I'm never going like 4 reps on barbell curls. I keep it up in the 10 to 12 rep range or even higher. But I ran into problems years ago when I tried to train like in the 6 to 8 rep range. I'd do a few heavy sets. And for me, that stuff just doesn't work out. And I've heard a lot of other people in bodybuilding say the same thing. You know, arms, you're already tackling them really hard on chest and back day. So if you are going to do an arm day to, you know, keep them up a little bit higher, 8 to 12, I'll even go to 15 reps. Hell, even sometimes I'll do 20 reps or more even, depending on the workout.
Have you ever, like, you do you remember the very first time you trained arms and you trained biceps? You remember you couldn't put your arms, like, you couldn't straighten your arms out?
Have you
ever had that problem? Yeah. Well, a lot of people do that, too. But a lot of people, that has to do with the tendon, too. And the tendon in your body is kind of stretched so much, your biceps are stretched so much, they're kind of, like, pulling back. So I think that's true. I think that what you say is extremely valid, and I think it's a good way to do it. Plus, I mean, biceps, you're trying to just get kind of blood in there. You just want to get blood in there. You want to get a full, nice pump going on in there, and it'll add growth to the area. I mean, they've also done – have you ever heard, like, the new studies that they're doing on these rubber bands that they're putting through – like, they're putting on the body? I forget the name. They're calling it something where they're occluding the venous pulse – or not the pulse. They're occluding the venous system and allowing blood to kind of sit inside the bicep while they train it.
They actually called it occlusion training.
Occlusion training, that's what it's called. And they're getting growth with that too. So
I mean, and I'm not sure how well that works. I have tried it, but not to a point where I've actually done it on a regular basis. I can tell you what, it's a very uncomfortable process, that's for sure.
I've never tried it. I understand the theory behind it. There's the NSCA did like a whole like hour long presentation on it. But that's just another thing that they're going to now. So to be honest, I just think people overtrain their biceps.
Yeah, absolutely. All right, Chuck. Well, thanks for coming back and being with me tonight.
And I hope you guys, everybody has a great night out there. And thanks for having me back on again, Scott. I appreciate it very much.
Absolutely. For Advices Radio, I'm Scott McNally with Chuck Zarowski. Keep grinding.